Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Ray Raphael. He is the author of the book Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation, a little late for the 4th of July, but nevertheless. Right now, I would like to welcome Orlando Leibovitz. He is the co-curator, along with Woody Veselka, of an installation or an exhibition, what would you call it, at Santa Fe Complex called Projected Light Illuminates the Night, and Andrew Edwards is an artist also in that show. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So what was the concept behind this? Santa Fe Complex is a wonderful place known for the attempt to bring together art and science and technology in lots of creative ways. And you decided to do this projected light show.
Well, it's part of a larger program at the complex called Summer at the Complex. And this particular event had to do with my desire to combine... It's kind of lighter on the science, but to combine technology and art. And one of the obvious ways to do that was to do it via video. Also, because the complex is so multifunctional in what it does, we wanted to design a show that, when it wasn't on, disappeared. And if you have projectors hanging from bags in the ceiling and you're projecting on the walls and you're not having screens that you're projecting on, but rather on all of the surfaces of the walls and the floors and the ceiling. When the show's not happening, the complex can move on to its other multifunctional business. So that was the beginning of it. We were lucky enough to have Woody Veselka co-curate the show, and lucky enough to have Stena, his wife, be one of the artists in the show.
It is interesting when technology, when art disappears, when you turn off the power. I've often wondered whether the archaeologists of the future will think that we did anything.
Well, you know, we had this little conversation yesterday, or when you were at the complex, about a comment Stena made about technology disappearing. And that's exactly the point. Andrew's much more the technician than I am, so he might be able to speak for... how permanent this technology really is.
Well, it's always a question. It's definitely, some people would say it's more permanent in the sense that, you know, film degrades and you have the emulsion that degrades, but, you know, digital is always going to be upgrading. You don't know what formats all of this work is going to be in the next 10, 20 years. And so who knows whether or not the formats we're using now will be viable. You know, people who have work on VHS, it's slowly starting to become, tapes are even starting to become obsolete. So... You know,
yeah, I mean, one of the things, when Stena was on the air, I guess it was last year, whenever she had the retrospective at the at Site Santa Fe, she said something that I thought was very moving, which is that the technology that she really came into her own as an artist on is not usable anymore, whereas oil painting persists and all sorts of other things
right.
persist, but these gigantic format videotapes, you can't even get a machine that will play them. And I've often wondered, actually, whether this idea of impermanence isn't, to some extent, intentional in the sense of taking away the preciousness of the art object.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that. I mean, it's a little more complicated with the technology we're talking about, for example, than it is with daguerreotypes, which were formulated in the 1850s. So... Daguerreotypes came along, and for a multitude of reasons, that technology of daguerreotypes was superseded by paper prints. But now you have a resurgence of people working in daguerreotypes. So that might not be exactly equivalent, because I'm not sure once VHS or some technology is gone, I'm not sure if you can resurrect it again
right.
where you can with daguerreotypes. So I think we just have to wait and see how that plays out. What do you think, Andrew?
There's something about the physical sort of a film or photographs that in a way is more long-lasting than digital.
Yes.
Because they degrade over time, but it's a real-world object that you can preserve. And if, you know, with the difference between digital photography and, you know, actually making real prints... is that the prints are a physical object that you can have last for a long time if you pay attention to the acids. But digital, you know, you never know when the technology you're using is going to be outdated and no longer resurrected. So it's sort of a give and take, because in a way the digital could last forever if you keep moving moving it into the new technology. But it's an interesting dialogue.
But in a way, what it's really all about is the here and now. And and for example, in this exhibition at Santa Fe Complex, projected light illuminates the night. It starts at sunset, which this Friday and Saturday is at 8:22, and goes until 10:30. And there's a nice light that's in the air, that's in the sky when the sun goes down, because it goes down relatively slowly.
Well, that was intentional. We're projecting, as you know, on the outside of the building as well. And I really wanted to see what it would be like as it started to get dark. Mm-hmm. As it starts to get dark, the projections on the outside of the building become more saturated because there's less and less ambient light. So that was just a little something I wanted to do for myself that I hope other people appreciated. It looked beautiful. Last night was the full moon, and although the full moon was facing the facade of the building and it washed out some of the color, the combination of looking one way and seeing the facade of the building and turning the other way and seeing this incredibly dark blue sky with the moon in it was really amazing.
Yeah. Andrew Edwards, you have a piece called Populous. Tell us about your piece.
The piece is a live video interactive work that basically there's no content in the piece except for a live video pointing back at the viewer. So people come and look at the piece and they are in it. They become the star of the piece. But what happens is, as the evening goes on, everyone who has looked at the piece sort of comes together into one composition. It basically compresses the series of time into this one moment, so you get this series of looping moments from the entire night that collage into one large projection. So it really makes people aware of themselves and their past actions and the other people who have been there. So people will show up to look at the piece and you'll see a series of movements of the last person who was there who's no longer around, and people are curious what's going on. They'll walk up and suddenly they start to become part of this piece as well.
So in order to look at the piece, you basically have to be in it because the camera is pointing at you. And there were some people having fun with it, dancing and doing all kinds of movements that then get kind of fragmented, and you have this almost like animated cell movement.
Yeah. For me, one of the most interesting part is watching people interact with the piece, because the piece doesn't function without people, and the way people break out of their shells was the most fascinating thing that I didn't think would happen as much as it did. You had sort of people of all ages moving around and dancing in bizarre ways and slapping each other in the face and sort of people doing things that normally would be completely inappropriate, but for some reason people sort of let themselves just go wild with it, which is something I'm always fascinated with, this getting people to stop, you know, pretending like we don't exist with each other.
Yeah, and what are the things that give permission to do things that are taboo at other moments?
Yeah. Yeah, and the way it functioned last night, which we had less people than on Friday, it was completely different than the way it was functioning Friday. On Friday, the whole place was packed and you had people running up in front of it. You had just groups of 5 to 6 people moving in front of it and dancing around. And last night, there were a lot less people, and you'd have a lot of people sort of watching from afar, and then they'd run up and do like a 2-second movement and run out of the camera again, and then they'd watch for a while, and people were a lot less timid, and I realized that it was the crowd mentality that, okay, we're all doing this together, so we can all make fools of ourselves, but if it's a solo thing, people are much less likely to participate.
There's also, at least for me, there was kind of a metaphor in the piece wherein you do an action, and then it persists for a while, even after you stop doing it, and then it fades away.
Right. Yeah, not only are you seeing the past people who have been up, but you're seeing your past self. So you make a movement, and then you move to the side, and you make another movement, and both of those movements persist with each other. So you become sort of hyper-aware of yourself and your body, because normally, when you're watching yourself in a current moment. But in this work, you see the entire series of actions that you've done the whole time, and it becomes almost rhythmic. It sort of becomes this sort of dance that maybe you didn't intend in that way, but it's sort of all of your motions start to move together and become this sort of rhythmic visual song.
Now, you did this piece when you were a student at the College of Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I created it a couple years ago when I was a sophomore. I just graduated in May, and I've been playing around with it as a tool for my own work to create imagery. And for this, I decided to actually put it up as a projection and allow others to get involved and make it into a sort of interactive installation. Before that, it had mainly been a tool for myself to work and create.
Orlando Leibovitz, so this is a whole exhibition that's going to be at the Santa Fe Complex. I guess the last night is Saturday night, July 12th?
Yes, Friday the 10th, Saturday the 11th, and Sunday the 12th. There is one thing I would like to discuss, if you don't mind, and that is the sculpture that's in the show.
The one called Rhythm?
Yeah, it's a marvelous piece the original sculpture was carved a number of years ago out of white Carrara marble by Paul Block. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because for this show, Ilan Shomaroni and Ben Lichter created a program that when you saw it when you were there, where you stand in front of it and the camera reads your hand motions and creates objects and colors that are on the sculpture itself. And when Paul carved the sculpture, he looked at the upper half as, I think the upper half was classical and the lower half, the shape of it, was for him a metaphor for jazz. And so not only does the hand movement create the light that's on the sculpture, but also it activates whatever particular music, whether it's jazz or classical, depending on where you are in the sculpture.
So you wave your hands in front of it, either on the top or the bottom. You make a shadow on the sculpture, and by making that shadow, you cause music to play.
Not only do you cause the music, but you cause those beautiful little kind of
forms,
figures that
yeah.
are yeah, kind of crawling up and down, dots and whatever else. But the thing that's interesting to me is, as you mentioned earlier, one of the main missions of the complex is to encourage collaboration of art, science, and technology. And to me, that piece mm-hmm. does it as much as anything else, in the sense that here you have a beautiful sculpture that was carved a few years ago, and now you have these two young men who create this amazing program, kind of a synthesis of technology and art in that sense. It's a wonderful piece.
There is something inevitable when new technologies are invented and artists get involved with them, which is that there's always a period where people do stuff because it's cool, mm-hmm. and it's not really artistically that realized. It's more like experimentation with mm-hmm. the media themselves in order to get to know them, and then eventually it matures into actually doing something which, for the people who don't care about coolness and technology so much, are interested in seeing.
Well, the thing, especially in the large room, the complex has one room that where we're projecting multi-channel, six channels around all the walls and the floors and the ceiling. That room's about 26 by 56, and it's an art ceiling that's maybe 20 feet high at the top. And the work that's in there is the work of seven or eight video artists. It's very easy, in my estimation, with video art to have people think that the technology can carry mm-hmm. can carry it as far as art is concerned. And for me, one of the successes of this show is that none of that exists, that what happens there is the technology is really wonderful, but everything in that show just works as an art piece. Mm-hmm. And the technology really, which enabled it, is a byproduct. I don't see the technology kind of superseding the aesthetic of what the artists were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, a lot of time in new media, people don't pay as much attention to the principles of art, of graphic design and composition and all the things. It's sort of more about the technology itself, and you lose that aesthetic sort of consideration. But I feel like the artists in this, most of them moved over from pre-technology. They have work that they were doing before this technology was the primary usage, so that they developed these principles and this sort of aesthetic practice before the technology and didn't let the technology guide their decisions.
Right.
And the other thing about the projections in the big room is because it's immersive and you're surrounded by everything, the art really isn't just the video. The art is the interplay between the video and the projections that go across the walls and the floor and the ceiling.
And the people.
Friday, when there were a lot of people there, the projections the videos were being projected on the people as well. And the whole interaction of everything was one of my intentions, and it's another one as a curator that I was quite satisfied with.
So there's a lot of different artists in the show. David Stout and Corey Metcalf have a piece, and they are, of course, with the late College of Santa Fe, and a great sadness of the brain drain that is coming about as a result of the closing of the College of Santa Fe. All these intensely creative people have, many of them have taken jobs elsewhere.
Yeah, and the students who were their students, I mean, hopefully something else will happen there, but I mean, Andrew is a prime example of somebody whose art flourished in that environment with David.
But meanwhile, the Santa Fe complex is taking up some of the creative juice that that exists in this city to get some of this work out.
We are. The list of artists is very good. Some are international. We have German-Czech team of Michael Bielitsky and Camila Richter. They're part of the projections on the facade of the building. Local or New Mexico artists include Susanna Carlisle and Mariana Amster and Jim Coker. We've got a Japanese American artist, Hisao Ahira. Of course, Stena is in Santa Fe, and her work is there. Paul Sharitz, who's not so well known, his work is just astounding work that's there. So there's a Kira Crowell is got a room to herself there. So I think there's an astounding list of artists.
Projected Light Illuminates the Night is at Santa Fe Complex this coming weekend, Friday and Saturday, July 11th and 12th. Is that right?
It's 11th and 12th, and I don't want to forget Dr. Woohoo, who's the other guy projecting on the outside.
Is that Friday and Saturday or Saturday and Sunday?
It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Okay. And from 8:22 is sunset, and that's when it all starts. People can come, of course, before or after, any time during that until about 10:30 in the evening.
Yeah, I think Sunday night we'll see whether we just turn it on for ourselves and let it run longer. We'll see how that works.
Orlando Leibovitz is co-curator of this project. Andrew Edwards is an artist. Thank you both so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Ray Raphael. He is the author of the book Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation, published by The New Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm pleased to be with you.
So you're writing about the founders of our nation, and the founders that we know about and that they make HBO series about and so on are not the only important people. You chose seven, only one of whom, George Washington, is very well known. How did you choose the others?
Well, I was looking for a more representative sample. The people we usually hear about come from a very small segment of society, and their contributions to the founding of the country were of a very specific nature that did not include many of the dramatic events that actually created the nation. So I was trying to find a more representative lot. And the first thing I needed to do was I had to have tracks for the people who I was going to cover, traces. They had to have left a written record. So that narrows the scope down from about 2 million people to just maybe a couple of thousand.
Right.
And then within that, I'm looking for diversity of region, class, gender, and orientation. And what did the revolution and the founding of the new nation mean to these different people? One of my characters, I can reveal who in a little bit, was basically a land developer. Another was into free trade and commerce. And another was into pure virtue, pure Republican virtue, where all leaders should just never have their own interest at stake. And another was into power to the people, the body of the people, and let the people decide everything. And another was into local control of communities. And all these different viewpoints really converge in the revolution, but unless we recognize that diversity, we have a very one-dimensional look at what our country was all about.
It's interesting, the cast of characters that you said sounds very much like the kinds of people that we still have active in all sectors of society.
Exactly. And then out of that diversity, we move on. We do things. And that's what happened then. Through all of their differences, and in many senses, these people are actually conflicting with each other. They actually rub against each other and fight, you know, politically, just like we see people do. But on one level, there was this something that they had in common. They all believed that the fundamental source of authority in a government comes from the people. And it was time to institute a government that purely recognized that fact, was founded on that fact. No monarchy, no aristocracy. So they had that common basis, and then, of course, initially they had a common enemy to get to where they wanted to go, because they had to overthrow British rule, because the British would not allow them to have that basic autonomy.
So this idea of government rooted in the will of the people, even though that's not always what happened then or happens now, was in the 18th century a relatively new idea. Where did it come from?
Well, it was really a dominant view in the 18th century, but it kind of hadn't really reached full realization on the ground, shall we say, because of the traditions, the monarchical and aristocratic traditions in Europe. But it was really a cardinal principle of the European Enlightenment, from Locke to Montesquieu and Rousseau and so on, that government needed to be rooted in the people. And in addition to that heritage, you had just the very, very basic local geographic fact of people are here in North America, 3,000 miles away from an island that purports to rule them. So there's kind of a disjoint right there, and the combination of a free-spirited people in a distant community with basing them their views on these European values, European Enlightenment values of a popular sovereignty, it's kind of that's a convergence that evolves into the revolution and the founding of the country.
So tell us about some of the struggles over the question of who was included in quote-unquote the people. Government by and for the people is one thing, but who is represented and who's not represented, and what were some of the fights that happened over that?
Well, this can be seen really through two of my characters. Thomas Young, who's a community organizer, and he really spreads rebellion in seven states, and Robert Morris, who's the richest man in America and has a very different orientation. So if we look at Thomas Young, he believes that when he's all over the map. He's first in New York, then Connecticut, Boston, Newport, Rhode Island, Philadelphia. And he actually offers a constitution to Vermont and actually names the state of Vermont. And when he first goes to Boston, which is where he really flourishes the most, Boston and Philadelphia, he sees that they are building a chamber in the assembly chamber. They're building a gallery so people can watch. And he says, oh, this is fantastic. People can watch their government. That's in the early stages of unrest. But then within the next few years, people aren't just watching their government. They are becoming the government. They're meeting more and more in what's called the body of the people. And the property standards for who gets to be involved in this get relaxed until basically all the citizens of Boston can participate, not just the ones who have a certain amount of property. And these people start meeting not only interiorly and in formal meetings, but out of doors. They're meeting under Liberty Trees. They meet in Faneuil Hall, which is the seat of the Boston Town Meeting. But then when there are too many of them, they go to Old South Meeting House, which can hold, say, up to 5,000 people. And these are the people who are really creating the force of the revolution. They're the ones, for instance, the Boston Tea Party. Before those 100 or so patriots are throwing tea into the bay, there's these meetings that go to the 5 and perhaps even 7,000 number in Old South. And Thomas Young, my community organizer, who's really worked to build up this body of the people, he gives this rousing speech. He's a doctor, so he can claim a little authority here. Tea is corrosive to the Constitution and should be avoided at all costs, and you should drink chamomile instead, and everybody's hooting and hollering. And meanwhile, he's the one who first suggested in public throwing tea into Boston Harbor. When he goes to Philadelphia, which is one of the steps on his journey, he has this idea to actually, he and Thomas Paine and some others, of course Thomas Paine of Common Sense, they unite with what's called the Committee of Privates there, which is a group of militiamen who are tired of taking orders from their gentlemen superiors. And they have this notion that every person should vote, and anybody who's capable of defending their country should have a vote. And they actually overturn the conservative Pennsylvania Assembly in a great mass meeting of 4,000 people outside the Pennsylvania State House. Pennsylvania State House, that's what we call now Independence Hall. That was the seat of government. and they actually overturn it and institute this radically new constitution in which all people are enfranchised, all males are enfranchised. If you can fight for your country, you can vote. And there's one great provision, Section 15, that says if you introduce the law in the assembly, it cannot be passed until after the next election. And the people have to be, it's open house of the assembly, everybody can view it. All the bills and proceedings have to be printed. And then all this is public knowledge, so if your representative isn't going to vote for the bill you want, you just don't vote for him next time. So it's as close as you can get to true democracy. Well, this other character I have, Robert Morris, he actually winds up being the richest man in America, and he has a very different view of the polity. He thinks government is there to protect property, not people, and only the people who have a stake in the land, namely property in the land, should be entitled to participate. And he certainly participates. He runs the country all by himself during the war. He's once in 1776. He supplies Washington army and before the crossing of the Delaware and also Yorktown. Without this guy Robert Morris, we basically wouldn't have had an army. And he's on every government committee. He issues contracts to his own firm, kind of a Cheney Halliburton sort of connection there. He's a privateer. He profits from the war that way, legalized piracy. And he also hoards scarce goods during the war. So he makes a fortune during the war. So he's not very popular. But when the country becomes totally bankrupt, they say, Robert Morris, can you bail us out? This is at the end of the war, 1781, and we can relate to this now. The impending bankruptcy of the government, certainly I can, living in California. And Robert Morris says, sure, I'll do it if you give me all these powers. And they grant him dictatorial powers, near dictatorial, like he can hire and fire anybody he wants, and the whole government has to go through him. And he does bail the country out. He offers these Morris notes. If the Federal Treasury won't make good on its bills, Robert Morris countersigns, and that's good enough, and people accept the credit. So these two characters represent such a different view of the polity. One is very grounded in the people, the other very, very much into property. It's amazing that we know so much about either of them. I mean, it's amazing we don't know about Robert Morris, the most powerful civilian of the times, hands down, and we don't even talk about him because we don't like his story. And nor do we pay tribute to the body of the people, kind of represented it by my character, Thomas Young.
Likewise, you contrast the spirit of the Declaration of Independence with that of the Constitution, the former being very much a product of grassroots effort, and the latter being written totally behind closed doors. This is a contrast that's still with us. Help us understand more about those different approaches and some of the conflicts that arise between them.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying to do in Founders, is I was trying to write a history which genuinely represented the two ways that history kind of progresses. And usually we look at history as a kind of a top-down affair. A bunch of leaders do things and then stuff happens. But pretty much only when we're talking specifically about social movements, like the civil rights movement or the labor movement, we'll talk about bottom up, the power of the people. In fact, history is always kind of going both ways. It's just sometimes up and down those power hierarchies. Sometimes it's more prominently one way than the other. The Declaration of Independence, in the months before the Declaration of Independence, following Thomas Paine's publication of Common Sense, every person in the land was talking about this thing. I mean, there was over 100,000 copies printed up. They were distributed everywhere. That's as if there were like 10 million today, I think, if you prorate the population. And they're distributed everywhere. They're read in the taverns, and if you don't out loud, so if you don't read one, you'll hear one. And people are debating the issues, and then they start getting together in their local groups, their town meetings and their county conventions, and eventually the provincial congresses and conventions, and working their way up. And these lower groups are issuing instructions to the higher groups. It's time for you to push for independence. And We have over 90 of these state and local declarations kind of forcing Congress to take the route, because there are a lot of people who are very reticent within Congress to do that. And so it really was the outpouring of this dramatic bottom-up movement that said it's finally time, we have to take the step, and that created the Declaration, and it's a fairly radical document. And the Constitution, by contrast, was conceived behind closed doors, in secret, by only less than 70 men, and really only about 20 active men, and then with the intent of having only limited popular participation in government. I mean, if you look at the records, they're constantly saying we can't give the people too much access to government. They admit that there has to be some sort of base level, because government is founded on the people, but most of it is trying to contrive these mechanisms. They call them filtrations. They call them, we have to build a lot of filtrations to keep the government away from the hands of the people. And then they have to sell this to the public, which is a very hard sell. And the ratification debates are very heated, and that's where we sort of the top-down and bottom-up sort of mix. So very different. Our two sacred documents have very different histories.
We're talking to Ray Raphael. He's the author of the book Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. And it's a little late. It's not the 4th of July that this is airing, but close enough. I want to talk in a moment more about this whole question of British rule and what was being cast off. But let's stay with a moment with this bottom-up question. Where did women stand? Where did American Indians and black slaves and black non-slaves stand in this whole set of questions about forming a new government?
Well, that's interesting, because in terms of conceptions of citizenship, they didn't stand anywhere. The whole progress of this country has been a gradual level of opening up, and basically this was the first level. Instead of going to just propertied males, you were extending the franchise outwards towards all males, or all white males, all free white males, not indentured servants and so on. And this was a process. Even by the end of the war, a lot of states still had, the states still had property requirements, but they were getting less and less. But beyond that, what they were doing, it wasn't just voting, it was just active participation in government. This body of the people, some of these people couldn't vote, but they were participating in these demonstrations, and they were kind of basically lending their bodies. Certainly, some of the soldiers couldn't vote in their respective states, but they were lending their bodies. And then the women, women were not seen as active participants at the time. And then, of course, slaves were enslaved. I mean, they were very much not active. I mean, they were just, the whole idea was to keep them out of the picture, and the same with the American Native Americans. But these things were beginning to be challenged. And for instance, the slaves, enslaved Americans at that time, or actually I should say enslaved Africans, because that's the way they viewed themselves, as Africans enslaved in America, they saw these same concepts of liberty and sovereignty and were trying to implement them from themselves. So a lot of them ran to the British for freedom when the British offered freedom. And Native Americans, similarly, they were playing it to their own advantage, and a lot of them joined with the British because they thought the Americans were a greater threat to their sovereignty. But it's the beginning of flux in all this, in particular for women. One of my lead characters is Mercy Otis Warren, and she is, in my mind, the most political woman of her day, and she really exemplifies the change in attitudes towards women's place and women's activity in politics, because she starts out, she's true blue Puritan, as true blue as you can get. Her great-great-grandfather was on the Mayflower. Her husband's great-great-grandfather was on the Mayflower. And she literally lives just a stone throw from Plymouth Rock. And she believes in this whole Puritan thing at the beginning of the story in the pre-revolutionary days of women submit to the will of man and to the will of God. Submission, submission, submission. Well, that's not very political and it's not very revolutionary. But her brother, James Otis, is what some people refer to him as the first patriot because he was the lawyer who argued the writs of assistance case in the Superior Court, saying that those blanket search warrants were illegal, and because they were against the laws of nature, so they should just, the law of Parliament has no validity if it's against the law of nature. Very radical argument. So he's a very radical early patriot, but when he goes nuts in the late 1760s, Mercy Otis Warren kind of pretty much steps in and takes his place, and she's very well read. She got tutored at home and across the street at the parsonage with her brothers who were being trained to go to Harvard. So she got that full education, and then she just went with it. And she writes these hysterical, very flourishy, wild lampoons of the British Tories, and she publishes them in the Boston Stories. And she publishes them in the press, of course, under a pseudonym. She can't publish them under her name. She does a lot of writing like this. She becomes a very prominent anti-federalist. Because she believes, remember, in this pure Republican virtue thing, very much against what Robert Morris believes. He believes that it's all about free trade, and Mercy Otis Warren's the one who says, no, it's all about virtue. Most go across purposes. And so she thinks that centralized government is not going to help at all pure virtue because it's just too much power concentrated in one area. But she has to write in a pseudonym. But when she publishes her history in the early 1800s, sort of at the end of the whole revolutionary era, she publishes under her own name, and she has become so emboldened that she takes her former best friend, John Adams. I mean, these two were very tight. They had great respect for each other. They spent a lot of time together, the Warrenses and the Adamses, in the early days of the Revolution. Abigail Adams just worshipped Mercy. But she thought John Adams had betrayed the Revolution, and she told him as much. She says, that Alien Sedition Act and the power that you usurp from the people, you should be ashamed of yourself. And she puts that in print. And when he complains about it, she doesn't back down at all. And so here, this formerly submissive woman, Puritan submissive, submit to the will of God, is standing up and won't back down to the second president of the United States in public.
Amazing. Yeah. We're talking to Ray Raphael. His book is called Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. Let's talk for a moment about this whole question of guarding against too much concentration of military, state, and corporate power, and guarding against intrusive government. It seems like whatever measures were put in place, they didn't work very well, considering where the United States is at now.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because that's what their concern was these concentrations of power, and that's what the Revolution was about. The Constitution was somewhat concerned with it, but they let down a lot of the safeguards. They had this idea of separation of powers, which has something a lot to be said for that. But life has a way of sort of getting carried away with itself. And when you get, basically, there's a counter. I was talking about this thing about popular sovereignty and how strong a force that was. And for the time, it was very progressive. It's still a progressive force when you think of popular sovereignty. I mean, if that could be implemented worldwide, we'd have a whole different kind of world. But there was a parallel force going on in America, which was for westward expansion, and kind of an imperial force that we have this great form of government. We be so awesome kind of thing. And that kind of gives us the privilege and even the right and possibly even the duty to expand this outwards. Of course, incidentally, we will then also take the land, use the land, and the Indians have to get, move on out farther. So this westward expansion is very key and very parallel to the whole popular sovereignty thing. George Washington, certainly one of my characters, he embodies that. He's an amazing figure, a very effective leader and all that. People don't understand what his base motivation was. I don't mean base meaning, like bad base. I just mean basic, which he saw the whole conflict as an issue of control of the continent. He starts the French and Indian War. Literally, George Washington starts the French and Indian War by ordering the massacre of a French scouting party in the Ohio country in 1754. And that triggers basically a world war, war for empire. The British come on top, and then, of course, you know, the whole taxation and who controls the empire. And he gets denied access, and he sees it not just as a way to make him rich, but he sees that it's the future of America. Planting tobacco with slaves is not the future of America. He knows that. It's not moral. It's not good. What single crop economy. It's going nowhere. It's dependent on the markets in European markets. Whereas land, to him, that's the ultimate value. And the British will not give Americans access to the land. And that's his big issue, and it continues to be his big issue. And then after the war and after the country is established, he goes back to saying, yes, develop the land, and let's make a big canal from the Atlantic to the Mississippi river system, and let's have it go right through Mount Vernon up the Potomac and cross the Alleghenies and then and down to the Ohio. And that's his big scheme.
It's really quite amazing that when you have an idea of westward expansion based on the idea that our new form of government is so wonderful that we should share it with everybody, that creates such an incredible blind spot to the harm that you're doing to the people that already live there.
Yeah, that's the hard thing about good things, is if you internalize good things and then suddenly think that I'm so good, I'm awesome, and I'm better than others, then you're in trouble. So it's better to be good and not push it on other folks quite so much. I mean,
right.
that's my simple moral Ben Franklin-style philosophy. Uh-huh. You'd have to say it better than I did, though.
Another question that I would like to address is the question of what did the British do that was so bad that people wanted to revolt and start their own country?
They fail to acknowledge on any level how deep-seated this notion of popular sovereignty was, and that people living 3,000 miles away were not going to simply relinquish control to a parliament. I mean, they were obtuse, and I think actually we in the American Empire can understand this a little. I mean, you know, the notion that we were going to be recognized as liberators in Iraq stems from the same place, that you're not paying attention to what's really happening in distant lands, and. They just didn't get it, so they could have easily backed off just a little bit. There were other kinds of schemes that could have raised money from the colonists other than just imposition of taxes by Parliament. But then when things got nasty, they just did this kind of crackdown, which just backfired. I mean, when they cracked down after the Boston Tea Party, they had to pass the Coercive Acts. They closed the port of Boston. Well, that was bad enough, but that wasn't the worst one they did. They actually revoked the Constitution for Massachusetts. People who had been meeting in their town meetings couldn't meet for, they've been doing this for 150 years, and suddenly they're outlawed. And the people who had power to appoint their officials no longer have that power. So people throughout Massachusetts, and this gets back to the body of the people, they just rise as a body and say, no way. You know, if the British are that blind that they can take away our Constitution, we just can't be with them. And in the town of Worcester, for instance, just a small town, there's only 300 voters in Worcester. And on one day alone, 4,622 militiamen from 37 surrounding communities, all rural farming communities, all of Worcester County, actually it's half the adult male population of the entire county. I don't know if you folks down there can appreciate that. Imagine, figure any county you got, and then
Right. Imagine
half the adult male population. Well, of course, now it wouldn't be just male, so make it half the whole population showing up on a single day, not just to protest, but to overturn governmental authority. They lined up the British-appointed officials, the local officials appointed by the Crown, and they lined them. They made them walk the gauntlet between them. Hats in hand, reciting their recantations over 30 times each as they marched through these lined-up militiamen units for, you know, going over a quarter mile, 4,622. There was an actual, the reason we know the numbers is a participant actually counted each unit So it's not just like a big crowd estimate. This was the year before Lexington and Concord, by the way. And we don't know about this because it's amazing that we don't. That's why I want to bring these kinds of stories out. That's the power of the people, and that's the power that the British failed to understand and recognize, and that's why they had to, the following year, march on Lexington and Concord, trying to reconquer a province that they had already lost.
It's so interesting to read about revolutionary and colonial and the early years of this nation, of the United States, because we see so many parallels to our lives now. The revolutionary spirit that you just described in that incident and that's described throughout the book, where do you see that alive and well today?
Wow. Well, it's alive and well in bits and pieces. I'd say it's most alive and well really on local levels. Where that kind of like that spirit in Worcester, these people are defending not just their individual selves but their collective communities. And when I see people coming together, and there's just this immense sort of kind of infrastructure of, I mean, this doesn't sound very revolutionary, but let's just look at like farmers markets. I mean, these things are just emerging from the people, and they're coming and they're involving people, and there's no hierarchies, and they're just, and people have a concept about spreading good food in a way that helps everybody, and kind of taking joy in the process. It's very democratic and it's very progressive, and I see that. I see certainly in the kind of level of the internet campaign that came on. We saw that on a broader level with the popular movement in the election, but then it's so hard to get through the. It's so hard to kind of get to that level in kind of mass market ways. Here in California, for instance, we have this marvelous institution called referendums, and it seems so democratic, and it is so destructive simultaneously, because what happens is big money comes in and distorts the whole democratic process. So it's very tricky, and it's hard to recapture that spirit, and I think the best way really is to start on the community level and go from the ground up.
Do you see that rooted in the period that you're writing about, or is it more of a kind of natural human thing that everybody does all around the world?
You mean the ground-up thing, the community?
Yeah.
What happened, I think, obviously it happens around the world. I mean, communities are communities, right? And that's a good point. What happened in the revolutionary times is because of this ideology of popular sovereignty, and because of the British intransigence, those two things kind of fueled. They made it possible for this localism to transcend localism and to become something bigger and to become a movement. I've witnessed this in my own life in the civil rights movement. In the late 50s and early 60s, and I went down south for a couple of summers as other young Northerners did, and what I witnessed there I just couldn't believe in terms of the local organization of people who had been totally oppressed and on a very fundamental level were staying together at building from their local institutions. And so, there's certain times where these localized things can move beyond and create something on a more on a larger scale.
Ray Raphael is author of the book Founders, The People Who Brought You a Nation. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.